Dr. Jerome Adams on the line, the U.S. Surgeon General. Been looking forward to this interview all weekend. Thanks for being with me, Dr. Adams. I have almost everything I want to ask you about is medical and trying to get the information out to the people that need it. But I have one somewhat political question, which is, we played earlier on the show your exchange with a reporter in the White House press briefing, Yamicha Alcindor, where she took issue, or she channeled Twitter people who took issue with your use of the term like Big Mama and Abuela. I thought you were just trying to connect and relate to people, but could you take us back to that moment and what you were thinking, and then having the discussion turn from medicine to political correctness on the internet?
Well, absolutely. So I started off explaining the fact that we're seeing in cities that black and brown people, people of color, are being disproportionately affected by coronavirus. Higher case numbers, higher hospitalizations, higher deaths. I went on to talk about the fact that many of these communities of color don't have the same opportunities to do the things that we know lead to health. So, for instance, only 1 in 5 African Americans and only 1 in 6 Hispanics have a job that allows them to telework. Many of these communities live in multi-generational housing in urban areas. And so when we say social distancing, they can't always do the same things that that are needed to be done. And I talked about the fact that the administration has put out 3 bills that address housing, that address transportation, that address unemployment, and that are really trying to give everyone, no matter the color of your skin, the opportunity to be able to do the things that create health. And then I finish by saying that we are not helpless. As individuals, there are things that we can do to live healthier lives that will also put us in a position to fight coronavirus. And this was misportrayed and mischaracterized by many, by at least some, as me blaming people for getting coronavirus. And I also used terms that I use in my own family. I use Big Mama to talk about my grandmother because my mother and my grandmother have the same name. My niece, my goddaughter, is half Puerto Rican, and she will be calling her grandmother Abuela. I call my granddaddy Granddaddy, and my kids call my grandfather Pop Pop. And so I used these terms, but one of the things I'm realizing is that when I'm standing in the White House next to the President of the United States, when I say things, they're questioned, and people question my authenticity. But I want everyone to know that I always speak from my own experiences, and I try to help rural, urban, old, young, black, white. I am the United States Surgeon General, not the Surgeon General for one party or group of people. And I will always fight for all of America.
Yeah, but I thought, and I am in a household where my wife is Italian, and so we refer to my kids' grandparents as Nani and Nano. It's endearing, yes. It's loving, it's traditional. It is zero to do with offense. It actually has to do with tradition and culture. And so I was just wondering if you were surprised when you're trying to give vital medical information that the discussion just turns towards whether or not you using these terms of endearment is appropriate.
It was very surprising to me. It was shocking. And again, it's the challenge of communicating in a highly partisan and political environment. And I just, you know, want to talk about health and medicine, and I try. And unfortunately, we're having to deal with the fact that everything is viewed through a political lens. And so I appreciate you bringing this up, and I appreciate the opportunity to relate to the American people again, that I really do try to be America's doctor. And I'm proud to be appointed by the Trump administration to be in this incredibly important role. But I also try to approach my job in a nonpartisan way and just tell people what I think they need to hear to be healthy, and to try to create policies that will allow them the opportunity to be healthy.
All right. Well, let's turn to some of the science, and that's a great explanation. We're really grateful that you gave it to us at Breitbart News Daily. But let's talk a little bit about some of the things people can be doing for themselves to stay healthy and to make sure that they're doing the best they can. You had a pretty cool video, dare I say it, about how to create your own mask at home. I'm someone who is a little skeptical of some of the mask mandates, because I think that I know a lot of the masks, the N95 masks, you need to be fitted for them. There are reports that there aren't enough masks in certain areas have plenty of masks. And I just see people using masks, and I don't think they're using them responsibly. They're putting them down on surfaces that are compromised. Talk to us about your thinking on masks. What are people not understanding? Where are people going wrong? Just give us some clarity here on how the mask can help people at this moment.
Fantastic. So you're right. There is a lot of misunderstanding out there. Originally, the CDC, the World Health Organization, my office, and most public health organizations across the world recommended against the public wearing masks because the best available science at the time suggested they didn't prevent you, if you wore them, from catching coronavirus. And that's based on our experience with the public wearing masks going back several decades. What has changed? Well, first of all, we've always told people if you had symptoms, if you had coronavirus or thought you might have it, you should wear a mask so that you don't spread disease to others because it catches the droplets as you're talking, coughing, or sneezing. But we've now learned that 25 to 50% of people who are spreading coronavirus can do it before they have symptoms or without ever having symptoms. So we can't just rely on you having a fever or a cough to know that you should wear a mask. So we now recommend that people consider wearing cloth facial coverings when they're going out in public and they can't social distance. But here are the key points to your question. Number one, it's not a substitute for social distancing. This disease spreads person to person, and the more we can separate people and keep barriers between them, the better to fight this disease. And the best thing you can do is stay at home or social distance. So it doesn't mean put on a cloth facial covering and now you can go and play full court basketball or go hang out at the bar. Number two, don't touch your face because we are worried that people will wear a mask or a face covering and constantly touch their face and adjust it. And they actually could increase their risk of getting disease. And number three, save the medical mask for the healthcare workers, because as you mentioned, they need to be specially fitted. And healthcare workers are dealing with people who we know have COVID. They need these masks, and if there's a shortage of them because people are using them and using them inappropriately, it can have more harm than good in the long run.
So this is what I'm observing, and I'm observing that people are, the doctors need to literally go into the nose and mouths of people who either have the virus or think they have the virus, and then they might. It seems like most places have enough masks, but some places probably still don't at this point for whatever logistical reasons. And then we're seeing people on the street who have a mask and then they're just putting it down and they're putting it wrong side down. They're not putting it in a bag when they're taking it off and they're constantly fidgeting with the mask. And it just seems like people are not clear on what to do. Maybe that's more of an opinion than a question, but it's just an interesting thought.
Well, I think it's a appropriate thought, and I've noticed the same things too. And that's what I've said all along is, a mask isn't magical, and it can actually be harmful if you're wearing it in an improper manner and you're not cleaning it and you're, like you said, laying it down and you're touching your face and adjusting it. And so if you are going to wear it, realize you still have to social distance. You still have to be meticulous, more meticulous about hand hygiene and washing your hands. And sure. And again, if you do it, just think about how to do it and go to my video. I talk about it, doing it correctly, wearing it correctly so that you're putting yourself and other people in the best possible position to be safe and not thinking this is some magical remedy to all that ails us out there.
Okay, so Dr. Jerome Adams is my guest, the U.S. Surgeon General, and we'll link up that video at Breitbart.com later today. So I've got a bunch more questions, and we've got a little bit more time left, but I'll try to go quick. Let's talk a little bit about treatments. Obviously, the mitigation is the number one strategy now, but we're all excited to hear about potential treatments. Is there anything we need to know today, and is there any hope for treatments coming out soon?
Well, dozens of trials going on in terms of therapeutics. We know that ultimately the game changer is going to be when we get a vaccine, because then coronavirus will be more like the flu. You have a season, you get a vaccination, and then you can go out about your business. But we're looking at different therapeutics, and the Trump administration is really trying to do everything possible to make it possible for patients and providers to have a conversation about some of these new experimental modalities, because we know that up to 80% of people who go on a ventilator never come off. So we want to do everything we can to make sure you don't get to that point in the first place.
So do you think that we can get back to normal without a vaccine? Because that's usually a year, year and a half off at best.
Well, we will get back to some sense of normalcy. We won't get back to the normal that we had before ever, I don't think. I think it'll be a new normal, but it may be a better normal where people are more cognizant of the spread of infectious disease, where they wash their hands more, where they do things, particularly during cold and flu season, that will save their lives, not just from coronavirus, but from the flu. And we've still had 25,000 people die of the flu in the country this year, which Certainly. Is a tragedy in and of itself.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about herd immunity. Well, what is the, is there a strategy that if some people, if enough people have the virus and are exposed to it and prove to just kind of kick it on their own, that that could potentially be a benefit? Is there any science here? What do you think?
Well, there is science, but it also suggests that it takes 2 to 3 or more seasons for you to get enough herd immunity for that alone to actually be an effective way of combating the disease. And that also only works if the disease doesn't mutate, which you don't get herd immunity from the flu that carries over season to season, which is why we need a new flu shot every year. So right now, we're still learning about the virus. Can't rely on herd immunity. Really need to rely on mitigation, first of all. Need to rely on testing and public health work. We don't close down cities for measles or tuberculosis. We test. We send people out to their houses and follow up on them and follow up their case contacts, and we isolate them. And that's really what's going to allow us to open up in the near term while we develop better therapeutics and wait for a vaccine to be developed.
And how does that connect to the fact that this virus could potentially recur in people? I think that there are some people who have tested positive multiple times. So that kind of speaks to your point about herd immunity.
Well, we know that some people have had it recur. It's important to know that that's less than 1%. Of all people. So at least for this season, we think if you get it, you'll be fine. And that's why we're working on developing the antibody test, because if we get the antibody test and we can figure out who had it, then we can return healthcare workers and police officers and people to the front lines, knowing that we're not, or that we're very unlikely to be putting them in harm's way.
Okay. So one thing that's interesting is that trying to deal with certain different setups for different cities and different populations, and even places like jails. I believe, I'm not sure if it's still the case, but I believe your brother was in prison, or one of your brothers. I don't know if he still is. But this is a very tough question, because a lot of people are calling for the release of prisoners. A lot of people are, but it's a lose-lose, because we don't want people to, we don't want to have a jailbreak, but we also don't want people suffering unnecessarily because they're trapped. What is the administration's thinking on this?
Well, you're exactly right. It is a concern anytime you have people packed into a confined space, and that includes nursing homes, that includes prisons, that includes other or housing in urban areas where people are tightly packed together. And so we're doing a couple of things. I wear a uniform because I'm the head of the Public Health Service, and a large number of my officers work in the federal prison system and are really working on infection control, making sure it's appropriate to have people in those settings and as safe as possible. But the Trump administration has also really worked on criminal justice reform and tried to make sure nonviolent offenders and people who don't need to be in prison are given a second chance. And I think that's an important part of this that we can think about moving forward, is how do we become more strategic and intelligent about our who we put in and keep in prison, while we're also thinking about how we can make it as safe as possible for individuals while they're in there serving their time.
So there's going to be a huge challenge. The president described it over the weekend as the biggest decision of his life, is how and when to open up our economy. And we're seeing a lot of hot spots in areas that are not as hot. And it's going to be a very tough call how to do it and when to do it. But we're looking at a lot of the decision making, I'm guessing, is based off of these models. And the models have always overstated in pretty much every area how bad things were going to get in terms of death toll. But talk to us about the fact that the models have been so heavily criticized and how much they're affecting decision making as we move towards hopefully opening the economy soon.
Fantastic question. And important to know that models are projections when you don't have data. And so our original models were people's best guesses, and or they were informed by experiences in very different cultures and very different places. What the American people need to know now is we actually have data. And so we're tracking that data, and we're not as reliant on these models as we are on saying, this is what's happening in California, this is what's happening in New York, this is what's happening in New Orleans. And we're following this data every single day, and we're giving that data to communities so they can make informed and intelligent decisions about when and where to reopen. And it's not going to be a light switch. Just like it wasn't a light switch going off, it's not going to be a light switch going back on. Different communities will reopen sooner than other communities, and they'll have to do it based on their testing data, not a model, but their actual data, and on their capacity to be able to follow up on cases and isolate them. And so I feel confident that some places will start to reopen in May, June. Other places won't. And it'll be piece by piece, bit by bit, but it will be data driven.
Okay, that's good to know. And so do you see perhaps that certain areas opening up before others? Maybe there's even a suggestion of quarantining or self-quarantining of those segments of the population that we talked about who have those comorbidities. Is any of that being discussed?
All of that is being discussed because we know that there are real health consequences to telling people to stay at home and not allowing them to work. We've seen domestic violence cases and child abuse cases go up. We're worried about substance misuse cases going up. We know that people, if they can't put food on the table, that is a health consequence of not being able to go out and work. And so we're trying to balance all of these and looking at other experiences in Italy and Spain and China and South Korea and places like Sweden. And we're going to figure out a sweet spot, and it's not going to be perfect because this is a new and novel and very humbling disease. But everything that we do will be data driven, and it will be based on our best guess about what is most beneficial to the American people's health, first and foremost. And the president, the vice president, and the task force have always said that, number one, this is about protecting the health of the American people.
Are there any examples of states or even countries that you think behaved particularly well or particularly poorly that you're looking at as a strength or a weakness for where we can go from here?
Well, this is a once in 100 years type of scenario. No one alive has dealt with anything like this before, and no one has gotten it exactly right. And so we're trying to look at every single place, and we're trying to say, okay, so-and-so did this well. And so, for instance, in South Korea and in Singapore, they closed their borders very early, and that's something we did here in the United States when the cases were coming from China. They also ramped up testing, and we've been pushing hard to ramp up testing, but people forget how big the United States is and how important it is to make sure you have accurate testing, because unfortunately, one of the things we learned is that some people jumped to ramp up testing but didn't have the quality and got many false negatives and false positives, which can be harmful too. So there are many lessons learned, and we are every single day the task force spends about half an hour going over the newest data and trying to figure out if we need to correct course. And I want people to know that everything we're doing is based on what the best data available, and we are always trying to be as transparent with you as possible. But it's a challenge. It's a challenge with a new virus and new disease.
Dr. Jerome Adams, U.S. Surgeon General and key member of the President's Task Force on the Coronavirus. I've got another half a dozen questions for you, so maybe you'll come back sometime, but I really appreciate all the time, as does my audience.
I love the conversation. Please go to coronavirus.gov for the best information, because we have a epidemic of misinformation just as we have an epidemic of viral disease. And so the best way you can combat it is with the facts at coronavirus.gov or your State Department of Health website. And thank you for the time and the opportunity to talk to your audience.
Thank you, Doctor. Happy Easter, and stay safe out there.